The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Patricia Ann Neely has had a long and varied career as a musician, educator, and administrator. She's also a passionate advocate for diversity and inclusion, especially in the early music community, and she serves as chair of Early Music America's Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access, or IDEA, Task Force. In what we hope will be an ongoing conversation, Pat Neely spoke with me about what diversity and inclusion mean and why these are important goals.
Well, I think in this day and age, it's an ideology that reflects the physical makeup and the philosophical ideology or beliefs that we are all contributors to our social history.
Mm-hmm. And why is seeking diversity and inclusion an important goal?
We believe that we had that all settled mm-hmm. back in the 60s with the civil rights movement. And the intention was great because it was a new idea. We had a great man at the helm who supported it and made it work. But then when he died, the civil rights movement died, and that was Martin Luther King, of course. No one carried on with the same fervor that he did. Mm-hmm. And diversity and inclusion is not something that you can achieve and then let it go. It has to be maintained. Mm-hmm. So I think we are back where we started from, mm-hmm. and we're going to have to rise to the occasion and engage people to start taking a serious look at where we're going.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard definition of diversity as being invited to the party and inclusion as being defined as getting asked to dance.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you see that applying in this context of early music specifically, or just the classical music tradition, or even just the professional music tradition
right.
in general?
Well, when I think about early music, I always think that everyone's invited to the party because it's new to everyone. And you always get enthusiastic when you can engage someone who hasn't done it. But there's another thing when you are invited and you're not sure. You come from a situation such as in classical music where you're an outsider because you don't look the part.
Mm.
You're playing an instrument that not everyone of your persuasion plays.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a disconnect physically.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come into a situation and you're quiet because you're observing to see what the protocol is. So what you're doing is you're trying to assimilate,
mm-hmm.
and everyone wants you to assimilate, mm-hmm. rather than just let you be yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the idea of inclusion is you're coming in here because you have something valuable to offer,
mm-hmm.
and there's a clean slate, mm-hmm. and that's what we have to go get back to, that we're not doing anyone a favor by inviting them and then not making them feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's diversity and inclusion as it applies to the people performing. But there's also diversity and inclusion when you're talking about, for example, composers and some of the history of some of these traditions. So how do we, and we can't, if we're talking about Baroque and early music,
mm-hmm.
That happened in the past. So it's not as though, we can encourage new composers because they would not, by definition, be Baroque or, early composers. So how do we wind that back? What are some of the ways we address that?
Mm-hmm.
Are there ways to find out who might have been making music or writing music in that era? And also, how do we address it from a contemporary performance standpoint?
Right. I think it's a multidisciplinary research project. It's not just looking at music and composers, but it's looking at the social history. Mm-hmm. And when we look at paintings or visual art, to look at it a little bit more closely. You may see an Italian painting of a party and everyone is, it's a bacchanal. But if you look really closely, you might see that there's a musician sitting there playing the lute who happens to not, he doesn't look like the people who are at the party. Mm-hmm. He happens to look a little bit more exotic. And then you look closer and it happens to be a person of color. Mm-hmm. When you look at representations of the cantigas, you see these figures playing instruments, and you see one playing a lute who is light-skinned, and you see one playing a lute who is dark-skinned, and you realize, oh, that's right, the cantigas were created at a time when both the Muslim world and the Christian world were basically together.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other instances where there are communities that you have never heard of in the Tudor period because we haven't done that research.
Mm-hmm.
And we come to find that when Africans or the Caribbeans, Native Caribbeans, stowed themselves on ships, they knew that once they landed in England, and once they stepped foot on land, they were free.
Mm.
So because of that, you find out that there is a community of Africans who are considered Black Tudors, who are professional people. One of them was Henry VIII's trumpeter, and they intermarried with other white English women, because they were mostly men who came up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's something new. That's something to consider as part of the social history that reflects on the arts, visually and musically.
Mm-hmm. So what you've just described sounds a little bit like, it's detective work, but it's also a little bit of, for lack of a better word, obvious. So in other words, you know, you look at a painting, as you said, and you made a point of saying that because we haven't done the research, because we haven't really probed any more deeply. So how do we do that? Where, what other places can we look to get this information?
Mm-hmm. I actually found the visual art from a source called Medieval POC, which is Medieval People of Color.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that person is still compiling that artwork, but she collected visual art that depicts people of color in social situations.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, from that collection, you can actually index. The index allows you to say, I want to see all the musicians that she's collected. Mm-hmm. And she has a collection from the time of the Middle Ages through the early classical period.
Mm-hmm.
And you see you see people in those positions of color as if they were part of a community. And that's the first thing to think of, is that where were they situated? What kinds of instruments were they playing? Most of those paintings are playing wind instruments, which meant that they were probably employed to work with a noble family. What you don't see necessarily are people of color playing house music. And I'm not sure why that, I mean, that's something I'd like to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
But usually when you see musicians with wind instruments, there is something happening
mm-hmm.
that is being depicted, something formal.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, looking at history, there are other signs of a questionable history, which we have to do a little bit more research on and dig a little bit deeper. There is a member of the Medici family, Alessandro, who was considered to be half black and half white. And they claim that his father was Lorenzo de' Medici, who had an affair with one of his servants. Mm. So he's partially black, but he's always depicted as with African features. Hmm. And I remember I was talking to someone and they said, you know what, I should try to find a program of music that would have been composed around his time and also find out whether he was a patron of the arts. Hmm. And someone said, well, no one has ever confirmed that he is half black. I said, do you know why? I said, because no one wants to know.
Right.
The longer they stretch this out, you know, the family is still considered to be one of the wealthiest patrons. Mm-hmm. But as soon as there's this dark character in it, sort of taints the family's history. Mm-hmm. The same with George III, whose wife Charlotte, they believe, was also half black. The British have never wanted to admit to that. Mm-hmm. But these are things that questions that have come up that I'm doing research on. Alessandro was not the nicest person, was not the best representative of the family. He had several affairs mm-hmm. with other women and produced two children who are, of course, his progeny, who are of color. And one of them happens to have been an arts patron, and that's where I am in my research. We have to bring these things, even if they're tough to hear, that's our history. And I have to look at my history here in the United States and where I'm from, and it's not always a happy discovery, but that gives me comfort to know that I came from somewhere. And I think if people of color have that opportunity to say, I did have roots in this particular place, it makes it takes away one element that prevents you from communicating with someone. It opens up a door, whatever, ever so slightly, that yeah, I do belong here. I can understand that. I can communicate.
So when you're talking about diversity and inclusion, you have said that, for example, one can see in various art forms and maybe in literature and various other historical sources, maybe there was a little bit more diversity and inclusion than we realize or appreciate or understand today. Is that, am I reading that right?
Yes, definitely. Yes. And as I said, history is manipulated in a way so that we envision it from a specific viewpoint. And now there's a rebellion going on where we want to, you know, everyone wants to do a 23andMe study, mm-hmm. or not everyone, but a lot of people have done that and now have knowledge about their own background, which could either be an extension that they want to tell people about, or something that they want to hide. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter. That's the history. We have to face the fact that, you know, that this is happening. Mm-hmm. And I think also the fact that politically speaking, this is a country that has always embraced differences. Mm-hmm. And this is now that we're fighting to make sure that we can continue to have that as a mission for democracy, I think this is a very good time to sort of say, well, you know, this is a discovery about our history as people of color that includes our cultural background, and that's very important to us because we have it all from the viewpoint of what we've been told by the people who owned us as mm-hmm. as a as a commodity. Mm-hmm. And now we're looking at where it is we come from and, you know, how we fit in.
Where do you think things stand right now in the world of music in general, but also specifically in classical music, Baroque music, early music? Where do you think we stand in terms of diversity and inclusion in the musical world?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that organizations like Sphinx, that have been around since 1996, have been the catalyst from which we have opened up the discussion. They took the idea that we need to bring people of color into the main orchestra world as their mission, and they did it in such a way that they continue to grow that population from their work with young students. They're always presenting concerts where students come for free, so that students begin to see people that look like themselves on stage performing. I think the same thing has to happen with chamber music. I mean, I think it's great that they're doing it for orchestras, because what they're doing is they're inviting people of color to go in and audition. You audition behind a curtain. It's a little easier. I'm not saying that it's easy to get in a seat in an orchestra because of that, but it's easier to be considered because no one's really looking at you. They're listening to you. Mm-hmm. When it comes to chamber music, that's a whole different thing. You've got fewer people on stage, and you never really talk to that person, even though it's an intimate setting where you're listening to them play. You never really know what it is and why it is they're doing that. Mm. And how are they communicating with someone who, you know, may not look like them or may have a different, completely different background. But we see it all the time. We see Asian musicians playing with Americans. There may be on occasion one person of color playing in a quartet. But what we need is to see more of that and to get people to buy into it more, mm-hmm. Because they understand that the music is theirs as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any specific ideas for how to do that? How to get people to see people like them?
We're at Early Music America has created a diversity and inclusion initiative. And what we're doing is we're asking, because apparently there are organizations that are asking that question. Why is it that we have people of color as singers, but we don't have anyone in our orchestra? How do we reach out to people? Mm-hmm. And Karen Brooks said that there was enough interest at the performing arts conventions that she's been to, that this is a topic that is now ripe to look into. Mm-hmm. And one way I think to start is by asking people how they've gone about this, whether it's been deliberate, or how did they reach out to people. For instance, there may be an orchestra that has no people of color in it, but there's an organization such as the Viola da Gamba Society, which has four members of color on their board. Mm-hmm. I think that the advice needs to come from someone who has had the experience. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say you have to present a situation where people see people that look like them in leadership positions on boards, as teachers, so that they can mentor other students, and on the stage, so that a child sitting there who has an interest can say, it's not far-fetched for me to say, I'd like to learn to play the viola da gamba or the recorder. Mm-hmm. And how do we go about doing that? Well, the committee that we'll form will have people who've had different experiences. It's not just a committee of people of color. It's a committee of like-minded people who are devoted and passionate about early music. Mm-hmm. And the discussion has to come from all of us as to how we are perceived, how we perceive, and what is it that we can do to make a genuine a promise to and a genuine one to break down those barriers and invite people, as we said, in to, and include them in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. You faced some barriers yourself as a young musician, and some of them were from pretty close to home. Some negative negative vibes you got.
Yeah. You know, I consider myself lucky to begin with, because I had my first experience with early music through an African-American teacher I had in high school. And I also grew up listening to Billy Taylor, who's a jazz musician, lived in my building. And while I was waiting for the elevator, I would listen to his trio performing.
Wow.
So, you know, as things evolved, I thought, okay, I want to be a musician too. I've got an idea. I love the sound of early music. I'd like to pursue that. And when I went to college, I had, as I mentioned once before, two of the best professors in musicology and medieval music and the Renaissance music. And I had an opportunity to hear these instruments and study with a teacher. But when I became a professional, that's when things became a little circumspect to me. I was not taken seriously, because the ideology of being an early music musician was that you had to be a scholar and a performer. Mm. I didn't walk around saying I had Edward Riley as one of my professors. I didn't really understand what was happening, why I wasn't being perceived as someone who was a serious-minded player. And sometimes we're apologetic about that when we do find out that it was something that may have been racially instigated. Mm-hmm. We say, well, that's just the way it is. My father always said to me, no one's going to hire you to play. You're black, you know, because he grew up in the Depression era and in the 40s, and he went to college, but he didn't achieve what he wanted to achieve through his studies. So in some respects, I understood what was happening, but I was also rebellious. And I thought, I had such support from my teachers at Vassar that I can't believe that the entire world's like this. So I made my way. I suffered a bit, because with every, even if you have the you have the motivation, you don't necessarily feel the support. So you take a step back. But with me, with every step back I took a step forward. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I don't know of any other reason that I shouldn't be doing this. And it's something that I think everyone who is a person of color always has to remind themselves of, that you do belong here. Mm-hmm. Because you want to be here.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other ideas for planting seeds for the future? Do you have any other, besides some of the initiatives and things that you've talked about?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there it's funny, but sometimes you use this nomenclature and you think, oh, that was kind of harsh. I was recently talking to someone who said, you know, I'm doing this project and I need as many people of color in the ensemble. Can you recommend some people? And I told someone that, who I was actually about to recommend, and we both said, I know it's harsh, but that's how it gets started, you know. So we have to sort of adjust our language a bit so that it doesn't sound like we're desperate to get this done, but that we recognize that it would be an advantage educationally and professionally, and will build interest. Mm-hmm. if we show, if we have a visual image as well, as they did in the paintings that I mentioned.
Right.
So that's the first step. And then to also have programs that will allow institutions, K through 12 institutions, to introduce the music in such a way that either it's through history or it's through actual practical lessons. The Viola da Gamba Society has chests of vials that can be rented or lent out to educational institutions. And one of our members, Pedro Funes, has created a vial consort of people of color in the school in which he teaches. And they have actually performed at the Boston Early Music Festival. So it's slowly but surely making its way through communities, the same way Sphinx has rolled out its mission.
So in general, those of us who are tapped into the classical music tradition, whether it's broadcaster or performer or just music lover, you know, we have been pondering just how to cultivate the next generation of music lovers and appreciators, and as well as players. So I'm really thinking more broadly, you know, truly just appreciators of the classical music tradition. Do you have ideas for ways to bring more people in general into this world?
This is really hard. We've been talking about that aspect of music for, I have friends who don't even come to my concerts because they're not, you know, they're afraid of what might happen, you know. I don't know whether it's that they might get bored or it's you know, you can't get up and leave. But this is a general thing. We do things to reach out to people that requires that we adjust what we're doing a bit. So the Viola da Gamba Society has a composer's competition, and more younger people who are playing other genres of music have discovered the instrument, rock guitarists. They're very facile on the instrument because it is pretty much very similar, and technique very similar, except you're adding a bow. So you see more, as the younger people get more and more involved, you see more people who are not just string musicians, but are interested in other types of music, bringing not only their technical facility, but their interest in that kind of music. And so I think we have to broaden our concept of what the instruments can play as well. There are composers who have written for the viol who are contemporaries, but, you know, there's a new generation using the viol in many different arenas. There's one who I think was playing viol in a rock band. There's an electric viol for those who want to play, you know, avant-garde music. And I think that that's going to maybe speak to people a little bit more clearly, because it's part of, it's not listening to the music, it's part of the whole social scene. It's you're seeing someone in a familiar scenario, but there's one thing that looks a little bit different and a little bit odd, and then you want to focus your attention on that. And then there is, you know, okay, if you want to hear me play the music that's actually written for the instrument, why don't you come to my next concert of English consort music, you know, and what is that? And then you can explain it to them in terms of what they understand from literature, from history and from religion. And I think that's the thing. It's like it has to be a multidisciplinary approach to getting people interested in what you're doing.
So it almost sounds like you're saying, you know, you can get people to try it once and have it catch fire a little bit. And then maybe you can mentor them through the process a little bit, you know, give them reasons, coach them along, bring them along in one way or another.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's hard to get someone to step over that threshold. Mm-hmm. But I know people who've come to my concerts that I grew up with once, but they've talked about it a lot. So, I mean, that to me is progress, because eventually, you know, I'll get them to do it again and they may bring a friend, you know. Mm-hmm. But in terms of how to increase interest in early music, I think it's on its way. The programs at Juilliard, programs at K through 12 schools. We have to see, as I mentioned, I was teaching recorder at a private school. We have to see the recorder as a serious instrument. And I remember playing for my class every year, the first class. I always play a recorder player from Holland, playing diminutions. And they'll say, "That's the recorder." It's like, yes, you can learn to play just like that. And in Holland, it's taken seriously. You start in kindergarten and you can become a professional recorder player by the time you're an adult. Mm-hmm. So it's changing the thinking, and it's offering another way of looking at things, which I think can also help our diversity initiative.
Mm-hmm. I know that as someone who is, I'm on the board of a chamber music organization, and, you know, we grapple with that concept of, you know, how to get new people in the door. The audience, the traditional audience at this particular series is aging, and the audience members themselves are talking about how excited they get when they see someone much younger coming to these concerts. So I'm really high on the idea of again, that kind of mentorship. You know, bring someone who's never gone to this concert. And it might be a young person, but it might be just somebody else in a different demographic that has never necessarily come to a concert like this. And that addresses the diversity from the other side, which is diversity of the audience.
Well, and there are other ways to do this as well. I did a concert of Jenkins and Laws, but the title of the concert was Laws and Jenkins Guard Thy Rest, which was part of a work by Ezra Pound. Mm. And it turns out this was written at the time that there was a revival of early music in the late early 20th century. Hmm. And Arnold Dolmetsch was the catalyst for that, but he was also mentored and supported by a decorative artist, William Morris and Edward Burne Jones. And these were the Pre-Raphaelites who wanted to go back and look at what the period was like in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. They guided him, and William Morris encouraged him to start building instruments. And this is how the early music revival started. Hmm. This brought people from all different places to hear the music, composers, writers. Bernard Shaw was a very big a supporter of Arnold Dolmetsch and wrote reviews about his concerts. So what I did is I created this concert where we looked at the history of William Morris and Arnold Dolmetsch and why everyone agreed that Laws and Jenkins is the pinnacle of consort music. It was at the point where William Morris wanted to publish these pieces that Arnold had found at the British Museum. That didn't happen, and he died at the end of the 19th century. But then in 1977, the two publications of Laws and Jenkins did come to pass, and that started a whole movement in this country, as well as in Great Britain. Hmm. So, you know, I always consider it was the end result of the collaboration of someone who wasn't a musician, but loved the music and a musician. And I think that, as I say, it's always a multidisciplinary ideology. Mm-hmm. So if we can think of ways to connect people with other passions that they have, that might be a way to do it. The Jack and Jill organization that I belong to is an organization for young people of color to do service to communities, marginalized communities, to become philanthropists, and to become cultural, you know, to gain a cultural knowledge. And they do programs every month, but for Black History Month this year, my chapter is going to be looking at the heritage of each member going back to the Renaissance period. Mm-hmm. And I thought this would be an excellent idea to bring my presentation on people of color in music and in art, mm-hmm. so that they can see how the social collaboration between their history and what we have as history, mm-hmm. That's another way of connecting the two. And then there'll be someone there who may want to look further into music and what may have been played, mm-hmm. at that time.
When we're talking about diversity and inclusion, you know, as you said, it is not a finish line to cross over. It's a process, and it requires a multidisciplinary approach. How will we know we're on the right track, and how will we define success in, you know, addressing some of, mm-hmm. these inequalities, addressing some of the historical inaccuracies and oversights, and achieving true diversity and inclusion? How will we know? What are some of the markers that will be meaningful to you?
Well, first of all, we started with a survey, and so by looking at the answers to that survey, that they were people were asked to write, not just to check off multiple choice answers. We're going to see what aspects of diversity and inclusion come up on a regular basis that, mm-hmm. that seem to be the common problem. We'll prioritize the assessment. Mm-hmm. We'll also have to take a look at language, how in general we discuss diversity and inclusion, so that it really is a constructive talk. Mm-hmm. We have to look at what is called white fragility. It's saying, oh, no, we're not like that. No, 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 you have the wrong, you know, we're just asking questions about diversity and inclusion to make sure we're on the right track, rather than really sitting down and looking at what you are and, you know, basically taking the clothes off of this, mm-hmm. and saying that this is where we are. It's not that we failed. It's that we need to really put our attention on this aspect of how we deal with people. Mm-hmm. And that's the beginning of success. Okay. We'll never reach the goal, because there will always be something. It's like water. Water never stays in the same place. If you prevent it from going in one direction, it'll go in another. So there will always be that one thing that you neglected to take a look at that might be something that you have to attend to. But the successes are little by little. When you're talking about this, the simple fact that we're talking about it is success. That it is an issue that is global is one part of the successes. That people that I work with are knowledgeable about this. For instance, Jean Murrow with Gotham Early Music called me up once and said, I'd like for you to consider being on a panel on diversity at the Chamber Music America conference. I didn't have to go out and ask them. Someone else is looking out for us. Mm-hmm. And it's the same when looking at grant proposals. I've sat on the NISCA panel. And
what is NISCA?
New York State Council for the Arts.
Okay.
And looking at grant proposals, I mean, you don't have to say it. People are really conscious of how they want to reach out to people. So when the question does come up, invariably you're going to find that we live in the Harlem community. We want to bring this music to the Harlem community. We don't just want to live here. So there's this whole sensitivity of how do you react to where you live? Mm-hmm. How do you react to people? How do you engage with people? I don't want to say quid pro quo, but it's simply that you have to you rely on people to serve you in a certain way, and then you have to serve people in a certain way.
Well, Pat Neely, thank you so much for making time to come and chat with me about this.
Thanks. This has been wonderful.